I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. We've got a lot coming up in this hour, but first, there's been a lot of debate in recent weeks about President Trump's executive order that temporarily bars refugees and citizens from seven Muslim-majority nations from entering the U.S. President Trump took aim at the media recently, saying that they haven't been covering all of the terror attacks carried out by ISIS. And CNN interviewed Republican Congressman Sean Duffy last week about the president's stance, saying that ISIS and Islamic radicals pose a greater threat to American national security. His comments sparked a debate over different forms of violent extremism, and here's a clip from that interview.
You don't think there are white extremists? You don't remember Oklahoma City? You don't think that this guy who was involved in the mosque shooting said that he was inspired by things that he read online?
So you give me two examples, right? And in recent time, we're going to talk about the one example. And there is radicals all over the world and here in America now that'll take up arms and do bad things. But if you want to compare this one person in the last 10 years that you can give me an example of, Oklahoma was, what, 20 years ago, the Oklahoma City bombing, that's different than this whole movement that's taken place through ISIS that's inspired attacks. I mean, are you going to compare the one attack up in Canada to all the death and destruction in Europe from refugees
or
the attacks in the United States of America?
How about the Charleston church shooting, Congressman? He was an extremist. So,
yeah.
He was a white extremist.
Yeah, he was. Okay.
How about that? That doesn't matter?
No, it does matter. It does matter. Look at the good things that came from it. Nikki Haley took down the Confederate flag. That was great. Mm-hmm. But you want to say, I can give you a couple examples. Mm-hmm. There's no constant thread that goes through these attacks.
Ibrahim Hooper is a spokesman with the Council on American-Islamic Relations, which advocates for Muslim civil rights. He's also a native of northern Wisconsin and joined me by phone to offer his two cents on the congressman's comments.
These kinds of remarks are just symptomatic of the idea, particularly on the right wing of the political spectrum, that it isn't really terrorism unless a Muslim commits the act of violence. Whenever it's six people killed in a mosque in Canada, whether it's a number of people killed in a Charleston church, whether it's Oklahoma City bombings, all of these kinds of things, these somehow don't count as terrorism in the minds of some people. Only if a Muslim does it count as terrorism. We've seen mosques burned in California, in Florida, in different places, vandalism of mosques. We saw individuals murdered on the street in New York. An imam was shot execution style on the street in New York. And these are never regarded as acts of terrorism. They're either regarded as random violence or some kind of violence carried out by individual unbalanced people. So that's what we see. Whenever a Muslim commits some act of violence, it's labeled immediately as terrorism, and it's added to the list that is then regurgitated next time somebody who happens to be Muslim commits an act of violence. But there's no similar list for any other group, whether it's neo-Nazis or the KKK or right-wing extremists, militia members, who all have a history of violence in America.
Okay. And just to get to his point that what the congressman, I think he was saying, there is no comparison as far as these acts of these terroristic acts like the Charleston shooting or Quebec or San Bernardino, you know, that there's not a comparison because of ISIS and how coordinated they are in encouraging individuals to carry out these types of attacks. And I guess I just wanted to get your response to that.
It's ironic. There is a man on trial in Tennessee for plotting to kill large numbers of Muslims in New York. There was a recent plot to blow up apartment buildings in Kansas housing a number of Muslims. There were attacks on mosques around the country. There are acts of violence targeting American Muslims on a fairly regular basis, and these individuals, these public officials, refuse to acknowledge it, just as President Trump refused to acknowledge the killings at the Canadian mosque.
And why do you think that there is this focus on rather, you know, acts by Islamic extremists or ISIS, you know, rather than taking a look at acts we see with either homegrown, regardless of skin color, religion, whatever?
Because Muslims are portrayed as the other, and it's much easier to attack and mischaracterize the other than it is yourself. If it's a white Christian extremist doing it, you don't see it as part of your narrative. Well, Muslims don't see ISIS as part of their narrative either. So we need to acknowledge that on all sides.
Again, that was Ibrahim Hooper, a spokesman with the Council on American-Islamic Relations. Up next, we hear from Charles Kurzman, a professor of sociology for the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. Kurzman is a specialist on Islamic movements and author of a report released this year on Muslim-American involvement with violent extremism. Kurzman says comments by the administration and some members of Congress in recent weeks seem to downplay other types of extremism.
I think this is a mistake. There are a variety of forms of extremism out there that might pose threats to public safety. And I think that law enforcement and public debate should focus on all of them and not only on a subset. That would be leaving certain forms of extremism unattended to. I don't think that's safe behavior.
Okay. And well, one of the points that Congressman Duffy made in this interview that he did with CNN is that he was saying that there was a difference between the kind of terroristic acts that are carried out by Islamic radicals following ISIS. And here's a clip of what Congressman Duffy had to say in his interview with CNN.
There is a difference. Death and murder on both sides is wrong. But if you want to take the dozens of scenarios where ISIS-inspired attacks have taken innocence, and you give me one example of what's happened, I think that was in Canada, I'm going to condemn them all. But again, you don't have a group like ISIS or Al-Qaeda that's inspiring people around the world to take up arms and kill innocents. That was a one-off.
Is there a difference? I mean, are both or all these different kind of extremist groups in some way motivated by an ideology, or is there a difference?
I don't think there's that much of a difference between the mobilization of Muslim extremists and the mobilization of right-wing extremists. In both cases, we're talking about relatively small numbers, fortunately. In both cases, there is an active online community where propaganda and violent ideologies are expressed and shared and posted, and people communicate with one another. In both cases, you get this decentralized organization or lack of organization where individuals or small groups go off and do stuff on their own. So it may appear that these right-wing attacks are one-offs, but in fact they're feeding from the same poisonous ideological well as other right-wing violent extremists in recent years. I would connect it then to attacks like the Charleston church shooting several years ago, or the man who shot at a Planned Parenthood office in Colorado. There are actually dozens of these events every year. Fortunately, most of them do not result in fatalities, but acts of violence motivated by this same ideological milieu, this same set of websites and chat rooms and social media that encourages a paranoid, violent worldview.
So why do you think members of Congress or the administration take this approach then, that there's a difference? Or you know, why do you think that they're saying things like that?
I think there's been a concerted political campaign to focus on Muslim extremism as a wedge issue that divides the country, that makes it appear that Muslims as a whole are unwelcome in the United States, that undermines the religious freedom of Muslims and their right to worship freely in this country. We've seen, unfortunately, a variety of movements like that trying to block the construction of mosques, harassing Muslims, painting swastikas and other horrible symbols on Islamic centers, hate crimes against Muslims. There's been a concerted campaign in this direction. Donald Trump, when he was running for president, fed into that campaign. He said there were thousands of shooters like the man who killed so many people in the Orlando nightclub last year. Afterwards, Trump told Fox News, he said there were thousands of people like him out there. This level of exaggeration and fear and scapegoating of Muslim Americans, I think, runs unfortunately deep in certain political circles in this country. At the same time, I think there are people on the right who do not want to be associated with violent extremism, who do not want to answer for it, and who do not want to have to continually denounce it the way that moderate Muslims, which is the overwhelming majority of Muslims in the U.S., are constantly asked to denounce Muslim extremists. Remember, several years ago, the Department of Homeland Security issued a report saying that right-wing extremism posed a serious threat and was becoming more and more organized. And members of Congress who are conservative, consider themselves to be on the right, had the report suppressed and the office shut down and the personnel fired for having written what was basically a factual report done in the line of duty. Because they felt that it was maligning the right. I think that that we've seen these political campaigns malign Muslims in that same way.
Whereas, like the point that you made, people feel like the right wing would not want to have to account for extremists, but Muslim Americans are having to do that because of all the attention that's being given to ISIS and these homegrown attacks that we're seeing.
Exactly. If we can put this in perspective, violent extremism accounts for a very, very small portion of the violence in the United States. Last year, we were on track to have 16,000 murders in the U.S., which is actually down from what we had a quarter century ago, was 24,000 murders. So it's relatively peaceful these days. But still, that's a lot of fatalities. Of those, far less than 1% were due to violent extremists of any sort. And yet our attention and focus and fear of these violent extremist incidents seems to outpace and be disproportionate to the actual level of violence they account for.
Okay. And that's violent extremism regardless of what type it is? It was
of
less
all
than
sorts,
one.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
The fatalities from right-wing violent extremism in the U.S. are run slightly lower in recent years. It goes up and down, of course.
Okay.
But those figures, since 9/11, there have been more than 240,000 murders in the United States. And of those, Muslim extremists account for 123. And a good portion of that 123 was from one man, Omar Mateen, the Orlando nightclub shooter. So this is not a leading cause of death in the United States, and yet it does seem to be one of our leading causes of fear and anxiety. And instead of making us more resilient and making us put these threats in perspective, it appears that the new administration and some folks like Representative Duffy are trying to inflame fears and anxieties, not about all forms of extremism, but about Muslim extremism in particular.
Is there anything else that I'm missing that you would like to add about violent extremism and what we're seeing?
No, I just I would like to see us, the more general point is, you know, for this issue, as for all issues, can't we base our public debates, our political debates, and our public policies on evidence, on systematic evidence, instead of on all these alternative facts that people keep throwing out and trying to sell to the public, it seems like, almost every day.
Again, you were just listening to Charles Kurzman, professor of sociology for the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. He's the author of a report released this year on Muslim American involvement with violent extremism. We did reach out to Congressman Duffy about his comments to CNN's anchor Allison Camerota. He did not return our request for an interview, but his office did issue a statement which reads as follows. CNN's anchor, Allison Camerota, ridiculously compared radical Islamic terrorism to the randomness of getting struck by lightning. ISIS is a well-organized, well-funded terror group that occupies large swaths of land, has a functioning government, and an effective propaganda machine that inspires people around the world to commit terrorism. They have infiltrated the refugee population in Europe and have promised to do the same in the United States. The number one job of the president and Congress is to keep Americans safe. The massacre of Christians praying at Emmanuel AME Church is heartbreaking beyond words. Dylann Roof is a deranged racist, but he did not belong to an organized global terrorist group that has promised to infiltrate our refugee program. The government should continue to monitor hate groups like the KKK and prevent other domestic terrorist threats. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but we'll have more when we come back. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us. We turn now to the challenges of treating substance abuse in the state. Drug or alcohol treatment can be difficult for adults and kids struggling to kick an addiction. But what comes after treatment can be even more challenging for those taking the next step in their recoveries. Last year, I caught up with 16-year-old Lexi Lorbecki. The teen spent a year in treatment for her meth addiction at Northwest Passage in Polk County. A few months ago, I checked in on her and her family about adjusting to life after drug treatment. Lexi Lorbecki was ready to go home the month before she got out of treatment, and she knew what would be waiting for her.
Everybody else that hasn't gone through like treatment or hasn't gotten help or did like serious soul searching is still there and still doing what they were doing before. And that's scary for me. But I know what I have to do, and I know who I am now and what I don't want to be.
But her road to recovery hasn't been easy. She moved back home to live with her grandparents in Wittenberg near Wausau. But Lorbecki ran away about 6 months later.
Would you mind helping me find my granddaughter by posting that poster, please?
Yeah, not at all.
Thank you.
Lexi's grandmother, Mary Reisman, is driving around Anago on her day off and putting up flyers of her granddaughter at stores. When I met up with her, Lexi had been missing for almost 2 weeks. After treatment, Reisman says Lexi faced one hurdle after another.
When she came out of there, I had to hurry and try to find counseling for her and try to get her into a psychiatrist.
Reisman says it took 3 months to get her in to see someone. Ashley Vantomi says it's not uncommon for families in rural areas to struggle with access to resources. Tomi was Lexi's case manager at the residential treatment center, Northwest Passage.
You know, for kiddos, you know, like Lexi, who lives, you know, more in the country, is a little bit, you know, farther away from, you know, a bigger city where there's resources, that can be tough.
The state isn't blind to those challenges. The Wisconsin Department of Health Services offered counties financial incentives to expand a program that connects adults and kids with a team of providers where they live. But rural counties tend to face a shortage of providers. Those that do exist often struggle to make ends meet because of the state's low Medicaid reimbursement rates. While putting up flyers, Reisman remembers one psychiatrist she contacted would not accept Badger Care.
when you've got a kid that's on medical assistance, tell you what, the doors are shut in your face.
On top of that, Reisman says Lexi's past drug abuse made her a target among some kids at school. She says she contacted school administrators about girls who were bullying her.
They took the information down. Well, the next week when I called, I asked if anything had been done about it, and I was told, well, nobody filed a report. And I said to the principal, I said, I sat on the phone with you, and I told you the name of the girls, I told you exactly what they said, I told you when it happened, and you did nothing. That was your report.
School administrators say the specific details of how Lexi's situation was handled is a confidential matter between the school and family. But Wittenberg-Burnham Wood School District Administrator Garrett Rogowski says they're required to investigate and address any reports of bullying.
Whether it's written, whether it's oral, whether it's a student telling a teacher and then a teacher going to administration, whatever the means of reporting, it has to be taken with equal weight.
Rogowski says they're dealing with drug and mental health issues now more than ever. He adds schools have limited staff and resources to address the challenges facing them. In his proposed budget, Governor Walker wants to send millions to schools to help train educators to recognize mental health issues and connect students to services. As for Lexi, her grandmother found her in another state and brought her home. The last time I spoke to Reisman, Lexi was back in school. Her grandmother says she's working with the school and hoping to get her granddaughter all the support she needs. Wisconsin's program to treat severe substance abuse and mental health issues is called Comprehensive Community Services. It began in 2005, and most counties now offer the program, including Bayfield and Ashland counties. Elizabeth Skulon is the director of Bayfield County Human Services, and she spoke with me over the phone recently about the program and the challenges that counties face with offering substance abuse and mental health treatment.
To form the program has been very, very challenging because we both live in, Ashland and Bayfield County are both small rural counties, and so we don't have mental health staff. We don't have a mental health clinic like some of the bigger counties do in other areas of the state. So it was incumbent on us to find a provider who had all of the services or could build all of the services and then subcontract the services for the Comprehensive Community Services Program. So that was something that some of the other counties in the state did not have to do. How it's working, I think we're still building it. We implemented in 2015, so it started the first of the year, and 2015 was a very slow rollout in that we spent a lot of 2015 just getting people to doing some outreach and marketing about what the program was and talking to providers about whether or not they'd want to provide services for the program, and really trying to build the array of services in the provider network. So in 2016, we extended the program a little bit, and we hope to continue to expand it until our needs are met in our communities.
You mentioned that you had to find a provider.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about the challenges with the provider picture up north?
Sure. Well, we have some mental health providers. We have some substance use disorder providers, but we don't have as many as we need, would be my take on it. We struggle sometimes, particularly with youth, to find providers, psychiatrists, psychologists, substance use disorder professionals who really specialize in the needs of children. And this particular program is a recovery-focused program that focuses on people who have a diagnosis of mental health and or substance use disorder. So to find enough providers for the array of services in the program has been a challenge and will be, I think. You know, we continue to try to find additional providers to serve the people that have needs in our community.
And what are you hearing then from providers about what the challenges are for them to be able to offer these services in your area?
Again, finding the staff, finding qualified staff. Right now, there is, even statewide, nationwide, there's a shortage of just people to do the work. And in the caring industries, particularly mental health professionals, substance use disorder professionals, social workers, therapists, counselors, psychologists, psychiatrists, it's very, very difficult to find people to fill those. Even if you've got the work for them, it's hard to find someone who can fill the position. So that's been, I think, our biggest challenge has been we've had some turnover with our providers in the staff that they hire. And it's because there's so much competition for those professionals right now.
Are you talking about like over state lines? Because I'm just wondering if the low Medicaid reimbursement rate plays a role.
Yes, that does affect us. We are not a border state, so we don't have border state status, but definitely Duluth being only an hour and 15 minutes away from our county seat has an effect on the providers that are available, because the state of Minnesota has a higher Medicaid rate reimbursement and can offer more to the staff that they hire. So that is an issue. It's probably more of an issue for Douglas County than Bayfield County, but we have seen even our own staff migrate to Minnesota for those reasons. It's really difficult to retain them because we have a more metropolitan area close by that can offer more.
So it's difficult for the county to provide the same kind of competitive pay that Minnesota can offer because they have higher reimbursement rates?
Yes. I would say yes. That's accurate. And the same thing for provider rates. I mean, the provider rates are higher there. So that all trickles down to what employers can pay staff and how their benefit packages are reimbursed.
Minnesota's Medicaid reimbursement rates are 40% higher than Wisconsin, according to Betsy Beiler. Beiler is an outpatient and youth treatment supervisor for the nonprofit Human Development Center in Douglas County.
That is a huge challenge. It also means that no new businesses are going to be coming to Superior, really, because why would they work here when they could work across the bridge? Places across the bridge are not motivated to take Wisconsin MA because why would they? They can stay busy with Minnesota MA. And so that's really one of the main problems and why we can't get the services we need. And I think people want to, you know, there's private insurance, et cetera, but we live in an area where we have a large population of people who work in positions where they aren't able to access health insurance. And so they've had to use the marketplace, even though that's not even very well expanded in Wisconsin. And so it's a huge problem for people. And if you don't have commercial insurance, your choices are very limited. And especially when people are going through hard times, what they need is easier access, not more difficult access.
Okay, so if they don't have commercial insurance, they're basically out of luck. It's harder for them to get access to services because people don't want to take on Medicaid clients?
Right. Now we have, there's a lot of places in Minnesota that won't take Wisconsin MA at all. Now we provide mental health services on an outpatient basis. I've got really great therapists. I think we do really great work. We work with a lot of trauma cases, and we're all trained to use specific modalities for working with even kids. I mean, we have a four-year-old, we have 3 and 4-year-olds that we do trauma work with, you know, all the way up through adolescence into adulthood, of course. And so we do provide a lot of services. It's just not as many as I would like and not the kind of services that I would like.
What are the kind of services that you'd like to offer?
Well, I'd like to have increased children case management, where there's a model where you have a therapist and then a case manager, and the case manager's job is to be in the community with the family, to be checking in with them, to be reinforcing the things that are learned in therapy. And I think that it's an excellent model and totally takes the hour of therapy that we do a week and spreads that across and really helps them in ways that are really tangible, as well as helping meet their needs when they don't have access to certain services. And so I really would like to have that. It's something that I've seen in other states and that I think works really well. We have one child case manager that is currently funded through the county, and I, you know, they just can't do more case managers. But it's it is a Medicaid billable position, but through a match, the county has to match the money, and I can't do it without the county's say so. So in other states, say Minnesota, for instance, you can just bill Medicaid and have as many case managers as you want. A colleague of mine has 19 case managers, you know, for like 8 therapists or something. And I have I have 7 therapists and 1 case manager. And this case manager, she's amazing. She's worth like 3 people. So I have to pay them a competitive wage, which isn't even all that competitive, to be honest with you. But I do have to pay them more than I can afford, but because what I could afford was good 20 years ago. So the rate 20 years ago was comparable with Minnesota. And then Minnesota's kept going up. Like, they just got an increase this last year of 5%.
So one of the fears is that because of this inequity with the rates, that services might diminish or that
Oh, yeah.
Do you feel like it's getting to that point for you where you can't offer some services?
We are looking at different ways to manage things, but it's certainly a collision course. I mean, it can't be. Like, we've done a ton of creative things. Now, HTC, you know, isn't going anywhere, and I don't want to promote that, you know, that, oh, HTC said they're going to close, because, no, that's not what I mean. But I am telling you that if something doesn't change, we're going to lose more and more services. Like, we used to have a lot more services, and we don't. When I started here, we had tons of psychiatrists available. Not tons, but we had psychiatry available for your average person. And now we're down to psychiatry just for the absolutely most severely mentally ill.
Again, that was Betsy Beiler, outpatient and youth treatment supervisor for the nonprofit Human Development Center in Douglas County. Most counties are lacking mental health professionals and have federally designated shortage areas. In 2016, Wisconsin had 133 mental health professional shortage areas, according to the State Legislative Fiscal Bureau. More than 200 psychiatrists are needed in Wisconsin to eliminate the shortage and meet federal guidelines, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. You can see our recent story on the challenges with access to treatment online at wpr.org/superior. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from Lawrence Weiland about what's on tap for Book Across the Bay this weekend. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. Ashland and Washburn will host the Book Across the Bay ski race this weekend, and around 4,000 people are expected to show up to ski, snowshoe, or hike across the Shawamigan Bay from Ashland to Washburn. Lawrence Weiland is one of the organizers for Book Across the Bay, and he also sits on the nonprofit's board of directors. Weiland says he was there when the race first began in the mid-90s.
Although the germ of the idea came from the other guy who's been with it from the start, Andy Matthews. But I had just moved to the area that year. That was the winter of 96, 97, and was, you know, doing a lot of skiing, and Andy is a skier too, and so we kind of crossed paths, and he had this idea, and I was, you know, wanted to, you know, meet people and get involved in the community, so the rest is history, as we say. But he had been into an event, as I understand it, an event in the cities where he saw these candle or these ice luminaries with candles in them, an evening event. And I think that caught his imagination, and he sort of figured out how to make them, and then came up with the idea of this nighttime race. So he was kind of he had the germ of the idea, but I was there at the start and have been there ever since.
Yeah, well, and I know that this race has attracted people from all over. I have a friend who now lives in Iowa, and they're coming up just for this race this coming weekend.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's amazing. We have, you know, at least a dozen states represented, and a lot of it is friends and family, just like your situation, I think.
So what is it about this race that you think draws in people from all over?
Yeah, I think that we still retain a real community, a grounded, low-tech event. We've never been flashy, and, you know, we've had over the years offers of major sponsors, you know, who would want to put lots of money in it and sort of brand it themselves, and we've turned that down. You know, we're all volunteers. We use hundreds of volunteers from the Shawangan Bay community who are, you know, serving chili and grooming and putting out the candles and all sorts of things. And so I think the community feels that they really own this event but, you know, welcome people from outside the community to experience it. So, you know, it's not flashy. We're nonprofit. We're not here to make any money. And plus the uniqueness of, you know, a winter event at night out on the ice of Lake Superior. I think you put all that together, and it's odd enough and weird enough that it has attracted people.
Yeah, and when I keep watching the forecast coming up to this weekend,
yeah.
And I know that they're saying that it's going to be about 40 or 50 degrees possibly. And
yeah.
How is that affecting your plans for the race?
Well, we're full steam ahead with planning, and over the years we've had all sorts of different weather conditions. We have never canceled the race in 21 years. We've always pulled it off, something off. So I guess our philosophy, we just consider the weather and the conditions as part of the event. And what it allows us to do is what we do. And most people take that spirit and they come and they do whatever the conditions and the weather, you know, allow them to do. So in particular this year, first of all, the ice is good and thick out there, and a couple of warm days isn't going to change that in terms of safety. But the snow cover right now is pretty thin, and if we get that warm weather, it'll probably get kind of mushy out there. But there you have it. So, you know, if people are willing to tackle that and make a memorable event out of it, then that's kind of what we're all about.
Might have more people walking across than skiing across this year.
You know, I think so. We've been getting a lot of questions to that nature, and so my advice is, you know, there may be a couple inches of mush out there, wear waterproof shoes, and, you know, if you have those cleats that you can put on the bottom of your shoes, that may be a good idea. So that's kind of what it's looking like at this point.
This is just a massive effort. You've got lots of things that volunteers are doing. What are some of the things that they're trying to get organized before this weekend?
Well, of course, all the registration material has come together to get ready. The tents are going up already, the Ashland tent. So they have a whole crew on that. You know, in addition to just putting the tents up, they're, you know, somewhat insulated. We have to get power and heat into the tents, so that's, you know, other crews and other work. And there's another grooming crew who, from about a week ago, well, actually through the winter, they're out testing the ice thickness, because we choose a course that takes advantage of the best ice in the bay, and we can start making those decisions a couple weeks out. So they've been, the last several days, they set the course. They freeze old Christmas trees into the ice to mark the route. But they're setting and grooming. There's a crew setting up. We kind of do a big shoot at the finish line with, you know, a couple hundred of the luminaries, and again, that gets power and audio there. So on and on. It's, you know, when you think of it, for one crack, one evening, you know, it's over in a few hours, really. It's kind of crazy, all this upfront stuff that goes into it. And then we just tear it all down Sunday.
Yeah, and, you know, you mentioned the luminaries, and I heard somewhere it was like 1,000 luminaries across the lake. Is that
right? We always shoot for about 1,000. And this year, you know, Andy had, they had done a batch of, I think, 600 a couple weeks ago, and then they melted. So our backup plan, we've used this plan before, is we have the support of Pure Dairy, which is a dairy distribution outfit here in Ashland, and they have one of those, or a couple of those, you know, truck trailers that are refrigerated, refrigeratable units, and you can crank the temp down, and they're below zero, and so they are lending us one, and so we have a bunch of frozen luminaries sitting in a frozen tractor trailer unit, and it'll be there until, you know, we start setting them out on Saturday.
So if Mother Nature doesn't cooperate, you find another way.
That's right. Yeah, we do our best.
Well, and, you know, over the years, I know there have been lots of things that have happened during the event, and I'm just wondering, what are some of the most memorable moments for you over the years that you've been participating in Book Across the Bay?
That's a good question. You know, every year is unique, again, primarily because of the weather and conditions. We've had several years where it's below zero at the start. You know, some of the early years, I remember people, again, it was smaller then, but we had a lot of people, more people back then, kind of dressing up and doing weird things. We had a couple occasions the event has fallen on Valentine's Day. And we have had wedding proposals being done out on the ice on the course or at the finish area several times. And I think there was actually one wedding performed at the finish area after the race one year. You know, we've had the nights where there's either a no moon and stars, clear or full moon, are always memorable because it's just really a sight you can't get anywhere else except standing out on the lake.
Again, you were just listening to Lawrence Wyland, an organizer for the Book Across the Bay Ski Race. Up next, it's Wisconsin Public Radio's Week in Review, where we recap important stories affecting northern Wisconsin. The Forestry Division within the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources would move up north under Governor Scott Walker's budget proposal. One northern Wisconsin lawmaker says the move will help with recruiting staff. The governor's budget requires the headquarters for the state's chief forester to move to an existing DNR facility north of State Highway 29, which runs from Green Bay to Eau Claire. Hazelhurst Republican Tom Tiffany supports the move. He says some foresters don't want to work in Madison.
They like to hunt, they like to fish, they like to be in rural Wisconsin, small town Wisconsin. So it was limiting the pool of people that would apply for some of those jobs. I think it's really good to move the division headquarters to northern Wisconsin, and hopefully that will be accomplished here.
Bayfield County Forest Administrator Jason Bodine says the move may make state interactions more convenient.
The DNR provides a variety of different technical assistance to the county programs. Sometimes we travel down, sometimes they travel up. So the closer you can make that headquarters, the more convenient it is for everyone involved.
The governor's budget would allow current DNR staff in Madison to relocate to other state facilities in phases. Walker's proposal also authorizes the agency to pay for their moving expenses. The Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation would be able to issue loans once again under Governor Walker's budget proposal. Local economic development leaders in northern Wisconsin support the move, but they'd like to see a few changes. Governor Walker proposed phasing out WEDIC's loan program after a state audit found the agency failed to follow its own policies, costing the state millions of dollars. In a reversal, Walker would allow the agency to issue loans with money that's been paid back from existing loans. Iron County Economic Development Coordinator Kelly Klein says he supports bringing back the loan program.
I would support a more rigorous review process at the state level. We do a regional revolving loan fund here in Northwest Wisconsin that's been very successful, and I think, you know, the state could do it as well.
But Klein says he'd like to see loans made available to more types of industry. He says WEDIC loans benefited large manufacturers over small businesses. Scotty Sandstrom with the Bayfield County Economic Development Corporation also supports bringing back the loan program, but Sandstrom agrees that he would like to see more flexibility for small businesses and startups.
In our case here, if a small business wants to get started, perhaps having more flexibility of $5,000 to $10,000 just to get some things in place for them might be helpful.
Under the governor's proposal, WEDIC would not be allowed to forgive loans. A 2015 audit found the agency forgave two loans, wrote nine off, and deferred loan repayments on 13 contracts in 2014. The rate of babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome is increasing in small counties like Ashland. As Olivia Shalaby reports, the disease affects newborns with drug-addicted mothers.
Ashland County Health Officer Cindy Zog says they had 18 babies born with neonatal abstinence syndrome from 2012 to 2014. Zog says the county has struggled to address substance abuse.
Probably the biggest problem that Ashland County serves is the fact that we have such a, you know, we're a very poor county, and so we don't have a lot of resources. We also don't have a lot of resources in terms of treating people with addictions.
Zog says they also don't have the resources to treat drug-addicted newborns. Once they're born, she says the babies are sent to the neonatal intensive care unit in Duluth for up to 2 weeks. Zog says it's a growing problem.
For not only our county, but for the whole state, and many efforts in terms of services and resources and dollars are going in to try to address the problem.
Zog says the mothers are commonly abusing meth, oxycodone, and heroin. Zog says the North Lakes Community Clinic in Ashland received a grant in 2015 through the Heroin Opioid Prevention and Education, or HOPE, program to help drug-addicted mothers and women in the area. The number of babies born addicted in the state has quadrupled in the last decade. Olivia Shalaby, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Enbridge Energy has announced that it's closed on its $1.5 billion stake in the Bakken pipeline system. The system includes the controversial Dakota Access Pipeline, which has resumed construction since President Donald Trump took office. When asked if the company was more confident in the investment with a new administration, Enbridge spokeswoman Shannon Gustafson said in an email today that President Trump has, quote, made positive statements about energy development and infrastructure, so we're hopeful for a constructive and open dialogue on these important issues, unquote. The company acquired a roughly 28% stake in the Bakken pipeline system, which connects the Bakken oil fields of North Dakota to the Gulf Coast. The system does not impact projects in Minnesota and Wisconsin. When asked about protests of Dakota Access and Enbridge projects, Gustafson said the company believes conversation, not confrontation, is the best approach to resolving differences over infrastructure projects. One northern Wisconsin county is building a tower to improve emergency communications there. Law enforcement are investigating what barriers exist for emergency communications across the state. Bayfield County Sheriff Paul Susanka says the county has had problems with emergency communications since the FCC required changes to free up space on increasingly congested radio bands. He says the location of the county's towers, the terrain, and interference have resulted in marginal coverage for some areas of the county.
Well, it affects communications between our dispatch center and units in the field, ambulances and fire services, and law enforcement. And it affects our ability to page and contact those entities.
Badger State Sheriff's Association Executive Director Dean Meyer says they just formed a group of sheriffs and state officials to do a county and regional assessment to identify issues with emergency communications statewide. Meyer says some areas are struggling with agencies that are using different radio frequencies.
There's radio frequency incompatibility. Emergency messages aren't known, real-time information is not shared, and it puts the community at risk and it puts the officers at risk. So it's a high priority to get this project, keep it moving.
He says other problems include issues with terrain, a lack of towers, and a lack of money to upgrade equipment. Meyer says the group formed after the loss of a Wisconsin State Patrol trooper. He says communication hurdles were identified after reviewing the shooting death of 21-year-old trooper Trevor Casper. The group expects to complete the assessment by their next meeting in May. Victims of a house fire look to firefighters to quell the blaze, but who helps them get back on their feet once the fire's out? Disaster victims in northern Wisconsin may have to wait longer for help to arrive. Barbara Beeling with the American Red Cross of Wisconsin says volunteers strive to be on the scene within 3 hours, according to national standards. Beeling says they've always been able to find someone, but she says volunteers in northern Wisconsin are few and far between.
For instance, in Polk County, you know, we have a team of two, and so they cover all the way from St. Croix Falls over to McKinley, which is probably getting about 70 miles there. So that's a lot of territory to cover.
Sue Ames Lilly and her husband make up that two-person team in Polk County. Ames Lilly says they respond to calls for help when they can, but they're not always around.
At that point, they have to send someone from another area. Recently, we had a family event going on, and there were two fires that weekend, and they sent someone from the Altoona office all the way up to Danbury, I believe.
Volunteers have bounced back and forth between the Eau Claire area and northern Wisconsin in recent months to help connect fire victims to housing and other resources. Beilein says they could use more volunteers anywhere north of Highway 10, which cuts across the central part of the state. This has been Wisconsin Public Radio's Week in Review. I'm Danielle Kading, and that's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also follow us on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. You've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.